This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Ethan Allen is a household name here in Vermont. But like younger siblings everywhere, his brother Ira is often overlooked. Ira Allen played an important role in the founding of Vermont as the 14th state. Born in 1751, he was a land speculator, pamphleteer, politician, and revolutionary. Ira Allen is also the subject of a new biography by J. Kevin Graffinino of Essex. It shines new light on Allen and his prominent role in Vermont's formative decades. Kevin Graffinino was the Vermont History Curator at the University of Vermont Library from 1978 to 95. He ran the Vermont Historical Society in the 2000s, and he has authored and edited more than 20 books on American history and history administration. The Vermont Historical Society is releasing his new book, Ira Allen, A Biography, this Friday, September 13th. Kevin, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Michaela. Nice to be back.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. What is your take on Ira or Ethan Allen? What were you taught about them in school, if anything? What quirks about Vermont's founding continue to entice or confuse you? You can call in at 800-639-2211 or email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Kevin, I think it's safe to assume that you know Ira Allen at this point better than anybody out there. You have been researching him for 30 years. What is it about this lesser-known Allen that enticed you?
I don't know why I thought of this recently, Michaela, but I've spent more time with Ira Allen in the last four decades than anybody but my wife. So I do think I know him moderately well, at least. I started working on him in the mid-1980s because he kept popping up in all of my research on early Vermont, but he wasn't well known. One biography existed of him, published in the 1920s. I worked at UVM. There's Ira Allen Chapel. There's the statue on the green. But Ethan Allen is our Daniel Boone or our Davy Crockett. If you're not from Vermont, you've heard of Ben and Jerry, and you've heard of Ethan Allen as Vermonters. And I kept running into Ira, and I came to believe that he was so significant in early Vermont politics, economy, and everything else that he needed more attention. And so I started working on a biography. I turned it into a doctoral dissertation at University of Massachusetts, and I was about to publish it as a book 30 years ago, but then I left Vermont. Mm. I went out to Wisconsin and then to Kentucky and then back to Vermont and then to Michigan.
And I'm guessing they all said, Ira who?
Well, yeah, and it just kept going on the back burner in favor of other things that I was working on. And then about 2 years ago, my mentor, Nick Muller, in the last year of his life said, what are you waiting for? It's been 30 years since you finished that book and you haven't published it. Nobody else is going to write about him. Get the book done. And Nick being my mentor, I better do what he tells me. So I went to the VHS and said, here's the typescript. What do you think? And they said, yeah, this is a book. So here we are about a year and a half later, and the book is out now. So.
VHS, the Vermont Historical Society.
Yes.
And your book is dedicated to your mentor.
It is.
Nick
He's
Muller.
Also one of my dearest friends and a towering force in Vermont history. Mm. He taught at UVM. He wrote. He published. If there's a Vermont History Hall of Fame, Nick Muller is definitely in it.
Mm. Well, for anyone, as you mentioned, who has set foot in Vermont, they become instantly aware of the Allen name, but mainly because of Ethan Allen. I mean, there's the furniture company, of course, but there are also so many streets named after him. There's Ethan Allen Park. There's historical plaques that bear his name. I mean, the studio that we're in today is located in Fort Ethan Allen.
Yes.
In Colchester. And Ira really seems to get lost in his brother's shadow. And in the prologue to your book, you say that this was even the case back when he died in 1814. Why do you think that he is a figure that history tends to forget?
Well, Ethan is big, bold, brash, beats up everybody who disagrees with him. He's a giant figure.
Yeah.
And Ira is small. He is in the shadows. He likes to be in the shadows. He's not a popular leader of men. He doesn't have the qualities in his own day or in ours that would make people feel affection for him, want to follow him. He's tremendously capable, but he's not an guy goes to the tavern and rallies the boys, or he's not quarterback of the football team. He stays out of the limelight as much as he can, and it's a very different personality. Mm-hmm. Ethan is the biggest Alan, the oldest Alan. Ira's the youngest and the smallest. His brothers call him Stub.
Oh, I'm sure he loves that.
Yeah, he doesn't have the personal qualities that would make him popular then or in a television age today. Mm. He's enormously significant, but he likes to stay out of the limelight.
Mm. Well, let's start with Ethan and Stub Allen's childhood. Was there something about their upbringing or their lineage that would cause these two to become such prominent figures in the founding of an independent republic? I mean, they lived at this incredibly fascinating time of upheaval.
They grow up in Western Connecticut, in the Salisbury, Connecticut area. Their family is lower middle class farmers. And in the 1760s and 70s, if you're looking for advancement, if you're looking for adventure, as Ethan always was, Vermont is both the frontier of northern New England in those days, and it's kind of the Wild West of northern New England.
The Wild, Wild North.
Yeah, it's a place where the spirit of justice is more important than the rule of law, and where you come up and you buy land for pennies an acre, and you try to build a fortune, you try to build a life, and the Allen brothers get caught up in, does the Vermont area belong to New York on the west or to New Hampshire on the east? Both of those colonies are chartering townships, and you choose which side you want to be on. The Allens choose to be Yankees rather than Yorkers, and they buy up tremendous amounts of New Hampshire-granted land, which New York is saying, you must buy this again. And so the whole Green Mountain Boys Yankee versus Yorkers controversy is over which charters will prevail. Mm. Will we be New England or will we be New York? And Ethan becomes the leader of the We Are New England All the Way, and Ira participates, but he puts his time and energy into how much land can we get and where should we get it? He tells his brothers, you guys are buying down in what's Bennington County today. That's not right. We need to buy the Winooski River to Burlington to Lake Champlain. And he creates the Onion River Land Company, which is nothing but a land speculation partnership of the Allen family. By the time the Revolution comes, they own over 100,000 acres in Chittenden, Franklin, and Washington counties, and they're on their way to being the loudest proponents of it's New Hampshire and then Vermont, and the would-be magnates of real estate development communities. And the Ira dreams big. You or I, we'd worry about clearing our farm. How can we get a crop in today?
Speak for yourself, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. Ira's that 0.1% who see cities, who see commerce, who see industry on the frontier. And every frontier society has these guys. Almost inevitably, they're going to fail. It's the next generation that makes it happen, that makes Burlington a thriving community. Ira can see it. He just doesn't last long enough to make it happen.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hold off on his demise for now. But while you were talking about the carving up of what would become the United States of America, I was wondering what the Allens' relationship was, if any, to the Abenaki people that lived in the region.
slender and not concerned about the Native American population, as was true of virtually all of the European American settlers in New England. Ira claimed ownership of much of Swanton, the Abnaki homeland, and he believed, and I think was sincere in it, that the Abnaki gave up their right to ownership by not supporting the American Revolution. Some of them actually actively worked for the British in Canada, and that was enough for Ira and every other settler of Franklin County to say, we now own your the lands you would claim. And it's a story that you can track throughout New England history. The white population pushes the Native American population aside.
We're discussing the founding of the state of Vermont and one of the key figures at that time, Ira Allen, brother of Ethan Allen. If Ira Allen is somebody that you have learned about in your own research or you have questions about him, give us a call at 800-639-2211. Well, Kevin, one of the things I found really interesting in your book was the way that you describe Ira and Ethan both sort of bucking the traditional Christian orthodoxy of the time. Would you describe them as atheists, or was that something more complex?
Not atheists. And Ethan is far more vocal about religion and his beliefs. He publishes a book in 1784 called Reason, the Only Oracle of Man. And his argument, he's what's known as a deist. He believes in God, but he believes that God is all around us. There's no need for ministers or priests as intermediaries. And he is very decidedly not a congregationalist Protestant, as many of his neighbors are. Ira doesn't say much, but it's pretty clear to me that he has no particular religious precepts. He doesn't go to church. He doesn't belong to churches. And Ethan is the guy who really attracts the animosity of the congregational establishment. He is reviled when his book comes out for going against traditional Protestant precepts in 18th century New England. Ira, I would guess, agrees with his big brother, but I don't think it's important to him. He doesn't want to be known as a philosopher, as Ethan does. I don't think religion figures heavily at all in Ira Allen's life.
Well, let's get back to the land speculation that Ira Allen was involved in. There were some significant land disputes that he had to deal with. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, again, the question is will settlement in Vermont proceed under New Hampshire title from the 1760s, or will it proceed under New York title? And the king in 1764 says, well, I think it's New York. But he isn't clear verbally. He says it's to be New York. To the Yankees, that means it was New Hampshire right up until the king said so. So all of our titles are good. And fine, New York is going to administer, but we're not buying our land again. And that's the dispute. So the Allens are 100% Yankee. They do their very best to keep New York out.
Do you think any of this involved like an ideological concern about land in the Americas, or are they merely concerned about finances and title?
I think it's both. I think the New England settlers have a town-based, small-d democratic sense of how local government ought to work, and they believe that New York has a aristocratic, landlord-based, county-based system of government. They are particularly suspicious of the large landholders in the Hudson River Valley. They're near enough to know about it, and they believe in I own my farm. And in the New York system is tenant farming. You're renting from the landlord. And this is philosophically very important on the early Vermont scene. The Allens do a wonderful job of painting their New York opponents as evil aristocrats. They're going to hurt the little people, and we're for the little people. And they're very, very good at that rhetoric. When the revolution comes, they immediately say that all the New Yorkers are Tory loyalists, that they're all in favor of England, while we are brave American patriots. It's just they take the rhetoric of the revolution from the seaboard, from Massachusetts, from Tom Paine, from Patrick Henry, Sam Adams, and they adapt it for backwoods use. And it's just brilliantly done. They win far more battles that way than they ever do militarily. Hmm. They persuade the settlers that enough of them at least to have a majority that we're on your side. And Ira has a little more trouble being persuasive because he doesn't have that popular appeal. Ethan is well liked. And sometimes he's feared because he might beat you up, but he's popular. Ira never has popularity to help him along politically.
Mm. It's so interesting having this conversation with you, Kevin, in the midst of a presidential election. I won't draw any parallels or make too many stretches right now, but you can see the ways in which history repeats itself or ways we can learn from what happened in the past.
Yeah, there certainly would be some parallels in personality and type in modern politics. Ethan is he's a guy who jumps on the table in the inn and the tavern and gives an impassioned speech about liberty and egalite and fraternity and all those good things. Ira sits in the corner and watches and figures out, how do we make this work to our advantage, both for the state of Vermont and for the Allen family? He always drives those two horses side by side.
Mm. So a fascinating figure, but maybe one that we're not going to see featured in a Broadway musical anytime soon.
I suppose we could have a Vermonter out there as musically inclined. You'd have to put Ethan in because Ethan would do some great musical shouting, to say the least. And, you know, I always think of things in movie terms. Who plays these guys in the movie that's just supposed, I think, ought to be made? And Ethan Allen, it's got to be somebody like Russell Crowe in Gladiator. You know, he's big, he's strong, he's a John Wayne figure. Ira's more, I don't know who plays him, you know. Dustin Hoffman's too much of a New Yorker and too old, but it's the lesser, doesn't dominate a screen type of personality.
Well, we do have to take a break. We will get back to casting the Ira Allen movie in just a moment. We're speaking with Kevin Graffinino, the author of a new biography on Ira Allen. We'll also take some calls when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, we are learning about the life of one of Vermont's founding fathers. No, not Ethan Allen. Today, his younger brother, Ira, gets the spotlight. Our guest is Kevin Graffinino, the author of the new book, Ira Allen, a biography, published by the Vermont Historical Society and out this week. You can join our conversation. Are you a Vermont history buff? What facts about Ira and Ethan Allen do you have to share? Give us a call at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Let's go to the phones. We have John in Sharon calling in. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Kevin, how are you?
I'm well.
I just have to correct a major error, or implication at least, that Ira Allen's statements about the Abenaki at Missisquoi or Swanton and Highgate in that area, notwithstanding, there was a substantial Abenaki ranger component to the American military working out of Missisquoi and Cowessac or Newbury, Vermont, as well, in the Connecticut River Valley throughout the war. And there's a lot of documentation of this, including three lists of Abenaki warriors who were listed in government in congressional documents and being paid essentially as the eyes and ears of the American military.
John, thanks so much for sharing that point. I want to let Kevin respond. Kevin, I don't remember you saying something in direct contrast to that, but tell us more.
John is absolutely right. There was an Abnaki presence and participation in the American side of the American Revolution. Rhetorically, it suited IRA's purposes and those of the other white settlers who wanted the land in Swanton to say that they had gone to the British side. John is right. They served on both sides, and I did not mean to imply that the Abnaki were all participants in the British military side, because that would have been absolutely inaccurate. John is right.
Mm, thanks, John, for calling in. We have Jim in New Haven up next. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Kevin. Hey. I have a couple of questions for you. Sure. One is that IRA was instrumental in the Otter Creek or the Onion River Road that went from Burlington to Castleton. And I was curious as to why did it end in Castleton? What was the importance of Castleton as the endpoint for that road? And the second one is that as Surveyor General, IRA plotted out a lot of the land around here in New Haven and elsewhere in 100-acre lots. And so I was curious as to why 100 acres, why not 150, why not 200, why not 50? Was it arbitrary or was there a reason behind the 100 acres?
Well, on the second question, I think that was a standard for New England settlement of the Vermont Territory. I'm not sure at all why the road ended in Castleton, which was a small settlement at a small fort, I believe, in the 1770s. But you're right. IRA was Surveyor General, which meant he was in charge of Vermont's granting of the Vermont towns that New Hampshire had not covered. New Hampshire grants two-thirds of the state, leaving one-third for Vermont as a way of encouraging settlement, getting money, and in IRA's case, enriching IRA Allen. Instead of getting paid as Surveyor General, he takes townships, and he enhances his own land portfolio as a result. As Surveyor General, he also controls which applicants are going to get towns. So it's an enormously influential position at a time when buying land and speculating in land are the equivalent of the stock market today or Bitcoin today. It's how you invest your money inland. On the oceans, you invest in transatlantic waterborne trade. But inland, you buy and sell land. And everybody in the late 18th century who has money is buying land on the various frontiers.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about IRA's role in the actual war for independence from Britain.
He briefly serves as a junior officer with Montgomery's expedition against Quebec, fails miserably.
Yeah.
Montgomery is killed. IRA comes back to Vermont in early 1776 from Canada, and I think he said, that's it. I have work to do here. And he helps Vermont advance to a declaration of independence. Ethan is in prison at this point. He's a British prisoner of war. IRA assumes more and more of a leadership role as a young man at the drive to become the 14th colony. It's the first time anyone has broken away from the 13 colonies. And they use the rhetoric of, if you can break from England, we can break from New York. And during the war, he works to keep Vermont safe from British New York and Continental Army threats. The Vermont is small, it is weak, and it has enemies on every side, keeping it from being invaded and the Vermont government from being overthrown is quite a trick. And IRA is one of the principal tricksters of making this improbable little fledgling state survive for 14 years.
Which was initially called New Connecticut,
right? It was. And then they found out there was a district in what is today Western Pennsylvania that was also called New Connecticut.
Awkward.
one of Ethan Allen's friends in Philadelphia, Dr. Thomas Young, is, as far as we know, the guy who suggested Vermont as a name, presumably from Green Mountains, but we're not all that sure. But the first known use of it in print is Thomas Young writing to Vermont, to the settlers, and saying, I think your independence is a great idea. I'm sure the Continental Congress will love it. Why don't you use Vermont as a name?
Hmm.
And we did.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Dean and Charlotte calling in. Dean, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey.
Do you have any information on Ira Allen's possible involvement at Virgin's Falls? There was a grant dispute, a couple go-arounds where New Hampshire grantors were driven out by Colonel Reed and his agents. And in the end, I believe Ira Allen may have been in the first conflict where he throws out Reed's people and they kind of mess up the mill that they established. And in the end, it's Ethan Allen that drives out Reed's people and really destroys the mill. Do you know anything about that?
A little bit. I know that I think Ethan was more prominently involved in the Green Mountain Boys' attacks on New York settlers. Ira participates, but he's not a leader of it. He's more active at that point in surveying new townships and figuring out where the best land is, where all the mill sites are on the rivers that flow into Lake Champlain, because you need a grist mill. You need a sawmill. This is the most valuable property in most villages. And I don't think Ira acquired the falls at Virgin's, but he acquired the falls in Shelburne. He acquired the falls in Swanton. He acquired the falls in Colchester, which today is the city of Winooski. He was a smart guy about what a town would need once it had settlers. You had to have a grist mill. You had to have a sawmill. And he owned the mill sites. But I don't think he was actively involved in the disputes in what are today Addison and Rutland counties. That was more Ethan. It was more Ethan's style to ride into a settlement, scare the heck out of everybody, threaten to kill them all and all their pets, and force them to throw off New York authority. I'd liken the Green Mountain Boys coming to your little settlement like a small town in Vermont having a sudden visitation from the Hell's Angels. Those guys ride into town on their motorcycles. There isn't much you can do except submit. And there was no authority for them to appeal to. The only New York authority was as far away as Albany. And that's a long hike in the 18th century. Mm. The Green Mountain Boys could control events, trying to do it very carefully without actually killing people. That would have brought New York militia and New York troops in. But boy, are they good at the threats, the death threats.
Something to be known for, I guess. Ed in Addison is on the line. Ed, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Kevin, I was a member of the original crew that restored the Ethan Allen homestead in the early 80s. And Ralph Nading Hill, who was a big supporter of that project, always talked about a building on the Burlington side of the Winooski Bridge that he believed was Ethan Allen's, I believe, blockhouse. And he always talked about trying to find out if that was the real case. And unfortunately, I don't think he ever did. I was wondering if you knew anything about that building or heard anything about that.
I have very fond, not so fond memories of being with a contingent that Ralph took to that building in the middle of February. And I've never been colder in my life having Ralph show me, well, that one was a musket hole, you know, that's what that... he wanted it to be true. He brought in historic preservation and building people. And I said, you know, it's possible this building goes back to the 18th century, but it was Ira's fort, not Ethan's. Ira built it. I don't think we ever got to, yes, it is so. And I think the building is still there, if I'm remembering correctly, it might be where the Domino's Pizza establishment is on the river. Ira built a fort there about 1772, and we're not sure what happened to it, but I think the odds are very strong it did not survive, that it wouldn't have become a 20th and 21st century building. But Ralph was very persuasive. And if he wanted it to be true, he was a great storyteller. But all I remember is how cold it was.
I got to say now, if you are a Domino's delivery driver and you work for that Domino's on Winooski, on the Winooski River, you got to call in 800-639-2211. Thanks for calling in, Ed. So I really want to ask you about the University of Vermont, because starting a university was among the top priorities of the founders of the state. What was Ira's role? I mean, they have a statue of him
there.
They do.
Well, in 1791, Vermont is allowed into the American Union, 14th state, first edition. And as a state, the politicians of the day said, well, we should have a university. Real states have universities. Everybody knows it's going to be chartered. And Ira's role is, yes, I'll promote this. I want it to happen because I want to control where it's located. A university will help my property and my community. Basically, there's a bit of a bidding war in the summer of 1791. And various towns, I think Northfield bids, Williamstown, Bennington, Windsor, and the top bid is £400, mostly in building materials. And Ira just grandly says, okay, and he adds a zero.
Oh.
He says, I'll do 4,000.
Baller move.
Yeah, but it's got to be in Burlington. And that's why the University of Vermont is in Burlington today. He does donate the land for the central campus, the green, where Waterman is, et cetera, Royal Tyler Theater. Those are all on Ira Allen acreage. He never fulfills the rest of the pledge. He says that the land is worth about £1,500. For a decade, the university trustees and supporters hound him. We need the rest of it. We can't build without money. We can't build without materials. Yes, yes, I understand. I'm almost there, but he had no cash flow. By the 1790s, he's almost broke. So he ensures that Burlington will be the home, the city on the hill, which is good for him because he owns most of Burlington. But he does not, you know, the university has an Ira Allen Society for its biggest donors, but I bet they don't let you stay in if you don't actually pay the pledge.
Yeah.
Though it's kind of ironic. And the statue is there, and Ira Allen Chapel is there because James Wilbur of Manchester, Vermont, adopts Ira as his cause. He's a collector. He's a historian. He writes a biography. And UVM just cultivates the heck out of him. You know, we should put up a statue. Oh, yeah. So he pays for the statue. You know, we really need a chapel. Would you like to pay for that, Mr. Wilbur? Oh, yeah, I pay for that if we name it after Ira Allen, who was not religious at all. And when he dies, he leaves the university $3 million in 1928 money.
Wow.
Which is adjusted for inflation, by far the biggest donation UVM has ever received. He also leaves them his Vermont history collection, which becomes the genesis of UVM's collection of Vermont history. So Ira Allen Chapel is kind of ironic, since we don't have any evidence that Ira ever entered a church to do anything. But there it is. And James Wilbur was UVM's giant financial donor.
Yeah. So you have spent, Kevin, more than 30 years researching the life of Ira Allen. After all that you've learned and everything you've shared with us today, what do you think, you know, the modern Vermonter should take away from his life? Like, do you consider him a force for good or just a self-interested landowner?
It's a combination of the two. He's a complex human being. There are times he is unselfish. There are times he is very selfish. He does tremendous good work for Vermont while always knowing how it will benefit himself. He's not a cardboard figure you should put on a pedestal. He is not an evil person. He is a complex human being, different stages of his life. He verges on admirable, different stages of his life. He verges on why would anybody think well of him. But he's got to be in the picture because he does so much in early Vermont. He stands shoulder to shoulder with his brother Ethan and Thomas Chittenden as the most important political and financial and other influences in Vermont from 1775 to 1800. So you don't have to like him. You don't have to admire him, but you got to put him in the picture. And you have to do this with so many other people in early America. The notion that all of our founding fathers were pure, wonderful, never did anything wrong, George Washington never told a lie. We can do better than that. Think of them as real people. And we don't tend to raise people of our day to those heights in the way we look at them. Look back at with the same skepticism and with the same balance. He's worth knowing more about if you live in Vermont and you care about the state's heritage.
Well, thank you for helping us look back today. Ira Allen, A Biography, comes out on Friday. You can get it at local bookstores, including the Vermont Historical Society bookstore in Montpelier and on Amazon. Kevin Graffinino, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michaela.
Kevin will be at a number of local bookstores and libraries in the coming months. You can learn more at vermonthistory.org/calendar. Our history lesson for today isn't over just yet. Coming up, the story of Vermont's oldest cemetery and the Revolutionary War figures who are buried there. Any guesses as to where it is? We'll find out in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Before we get back to today's history lessons, I wanted to ask for your help. You might have caught the first two installments of our September series, School Stories, where we're covering important issues facing Vermont's elementary, middle, and high schools. On Tuesday, September 24th, for our final installment of School Stories, we're going to be joined by the Interim Secretary of Education, Zoe Saunders. As always, we want to hear your questions for her. But what we really would love this time around is to be able to share questions or thoughts from students in Vermont's schools. What are students concerned about when it comes to their schools? So if you're a Vermont student or a parent of one, record yourself or your kid sharing thoughts on what you wish could be different about the school experience. You can email us a voice memo to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org with the subject line School Stories. We'll pose these thoughts and questions to Education Secretary Zoe Saunders when she joins us on Vermont Edition the week after next. All right, let's get back to today's show. The Bennington Center Cemetery is the oldest known burial ground in the state. Some of Vermont's most famous residents are buried there, like poet Robert Frost, five Vermont governors, and Revolutionary War figures with graves dating back to the 1700s. It's also adjacent to one of Vermont's oldest buildings, the Old First Church. The church is now trying to raise money for its historic preservation. Here to tell us more is Mark Bushnell. He's a Vermont journalist with VT Digger and a historian, and the author of the books Hidden History of Vermont and It Happened in Vermont. Mark, welcome.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Doing well. So you wrote about the Bennington Center Cemetery on VT Digger back in July for your column Then Again. What drew you to write about the cemetery?
Well, I made a recent trip to Bennington that was really wonderful. I, by chance, arrived late in the day and the sun was low, and I walked by the old burying ground, and the gravestones were casting these long shadows. And just walking around old Bennington, it's a great place to do just a little bit of virtual time travel if you're interested in Vermont history. And it was especially so at this time of day, because it really made the light really made the veil between the past and the present feel particularly thin, if you know what I mean. And then reading the gravestones, I kept seeing these names that I'd encountered while reading books about the early years of European settlement in the region that would become Vermont. I mean, you're not going to find Ethan Allen there or Ira Allen there, but you will find a lot of people who just played an important role in those early years.
Yeah, who are some of the folks from Vermont's early years that can be found at this cemetery?
Yeah, and like I said, they're not, you know, household names. I mean, if Ira Allen's not famous, these folks won't be either. But they're important folks like Stephen Fay, who owned a place called just up the road called the Catamount Tavern, which it got its name because there was a mountain lion stuffed and put on a pole outside the tavern. And it was a gathering place for the Green Mountain Boys that Kevin Graffinino just spoke so much about, because they were this important force to first fight against the Yorkers for control of the region, and then, of course, the British during the Revolution. And this tavern was a focal point for the community. It's where Ethan Allen and others discussed plans on how to attack Fort Ticonderoga at the start of the Revolution. It's where General John Stark devised strategy before the Battle of Bennington, and it's where German officers who'd been fighting alongside the British were held as captives after the battle.
Mm. You brought up the Battle of Bennington. Is its connection to the actual town of Bennington? That's not where the battle was, but is it its connection the reason why so many soldiers and prominent Vermont families from this era were buried at this cemetery?
Yeah, I mean, it's the it was settled in 1761. I mean, first European settlers were there in 1761. And so, you know, people live there, and that's, you know, that's where the community grew up. And you'll find graves starting in 1762, like the first settler died then. And you were asking about the battle. Yeah, a lot of the wounded from the battle were brought back to Bennington to be treated. And unfortunately, a number of them died. There's a mass grave believed to contain the bodies of 29 soldiers. That's how many names are listed on it. 13 of them are American and 16 of them are German soldiers who were fighting with the British. These folks all died in Bennington in the days after the battle.
One of the things that is so interesting to me about this cemetery, besides the people who are buried there, is the kind of order in which it was established in this town. The cemetery was established, and then the church with which it is now associated. This kind of seems like reverse order.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. When you're standing there, the church just fits so perfectly with the burying ground, and it's this old, beautiful church designed by the same guy who made the architect who designed the Congregational Church in Middlebury. So it's this classic, and actually I'm told they've been doing renovations. You can visit anytime. It'll be back open to the public starting this weekend. But it doesn't come, it's not built for 40 years after the first graves are dug at the burying ground. They had originally built a meeting house that was intended to be sort of temporary in the town. And then after the Revolution, when they could, they put together this magnificent church next door to it.
So the church reopens this very weekend after
restoration
work.
I just spoke to someone at the church this morning to confirm that they think they'll be ready for the general public. They've been redoing the roof and things like that. So I wanted to mention some of the other people who were at the cemetery from this era who aren't that well known. And one of my favorite stories that I learned from visiting the cemetery involved a woman named Mary Tilden Dewey. Her grave is right by the entrance of the cemetery. And she's remembered, there's some nice signage there that explains her story, that she helped American troops at the Battle of Bennington while soldiers were sleeping on a floor. She was baking bread. She made 80 loaves of bread that her husband then took to the troops who were on the battlefield fighting. She was pregnant at the time, so her husband left her a horse in case she needed to escape with their 2-year-old son. But then this surgeon comes along rushing to the battlefield, but he needs a horse to get there. And she's brave enough to give her one way of escape and gives the horse. And she says, "That's fine. If the British troops show up, I'll just boil up a bunch of hasty pudding and throw it in their faces."
Wow. And she made 80 loaves of bread for the soldiers too. It's,
yeah, apparently.
It's impressive.
Yeah.
Do you know how Robert Frost came to be buried there?
Yeah, it's strange. It's a little bit of a mystery. I mean, he lived just up the road for a time. He was sort of peripatetic. He lived in a variety of homes.
That's one of my favorite words. Thank you for using it.
I don't know where that came from. He lived up the road in Shaftesbury, and I think that's the reason. If you read, I didn't write about this, but he had a lot of tragedy in his family with his a number of his children predeceasing him. And I believe the quote on is, there are a couple of poems posted by his grave, but it says, I had a lover's quarrel with the world, which really does encapsulate the tone of a lot of his writing. Mm.
Well, I did not know until reading your article that he was buried there. I always associate him with different parts of the state. So that was fascinating to learn. And Mark, I have to ask you, you've written so many interesting columns in the summer and throughout your tenure working with VT Digger. Can you give us a sneak peek of anything that's coming up next?
I am working on one that probably won't appear till October about the Long Trail and a couple of different groups that hiked, who were the first end-to-end hikers on the trail once it was completed to Canada. There was sort of a disagreement on what type of hiker should be using the trail.
What type of hikers?
Well, whether it should be these full steam ahead, just see how fast you can do it versus take your time and enjoy the scenery types.
Mm. Mm. Well, Mark Bushnell, thank you so much for joining us. We learned a lot from you and would love to have you back on again soon.
Thanks very much, Michaela.
And you can find Mark's article on the Bennington Center Cemetery on vtdigger.org. You can also visit the recently renovated Old First Church in Bennington. It is reopening, as we just learned this weekend. Very exciting. Before we go, I did want to remind everybody about our call for help for our series, School Stories. We are speaking with the Interim Secretary of Education, Zoe Saunders, on September 24th, and we are hoping to pose your questions to her and your thoughts about how schools should be in Vermont. We are hopes and dreams for Vermont's public education system. And in particular, we are hoping to hear from students themselves. So if you are the parent of a Vermont student or a student yourself, you can record yourself sharing your thoughts on what you wish could be different about the Vermont school experience and email that to us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. I also want to let you know about an exciting show that we have coming up tomorrow. The Vermont Edition team is heading to the Tunbridge World's Fair. The event has been an annual tradition for the town since 1867. We are going to talk with longtime fairgoers, volunteers, organizers, and ag experts. Do you go to the Tunbridge Fair? What is your favorite part? Email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org and be sure to tune into our live show from the fair tomorrow at noon. All right, that is all the time that we have for today's show. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Rick Barrett was our call screener today, and our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.